Welcome, Franz. Welcome to the space show.
Well, thanks a lot. Pleasure to be here.
How did you come to be selected as a cosmonaut?
Well, it was a a big portion of luck, of course. It was in 1988 when in the Austrian news there was an advertising that the government is looking for candidates for a joint mission, space mission between Austria and the Soviet Union. And, I looked at that and thought, well, maybe this is something for me. I'm healthy and I'm very interested in that, so I applied.
What were you doing at the time?
At the time, I was an assistant professor at the Technical University in Vienna, and I was working on my PhD. And so I applied for that, and it took another year and a half till I finally was selected with my backup to go to Russia for the training.
And who was your backup?
My backup was Clemens Lothaler. He was a, he is a medical doctor.
And what year was that? And then what happened when you got to Russia?
Okay, we were selected at the end of 89, and then with the beginning of the year 90, we went to Russia, and we had then a 2 years training, which ended then on October 2nd with the launch of our mission, and where I was then flying into space.
And you flew up to the Russian space station Mir?
That's correct. On October 2nd in 91, I was launched. And I flew up to the space station Mir.
When we see a launch of a Soyuz, we often see a view inside the capsule. They broadcast the view live back down to Earth, do they?
Sorry, say that again.
We often see a view from inside the capsule, and it appears to be broadcast down live to Earth, whereas in the shuttle they don't broadcast pictures down to Earth during the launch.
Well, that's right. During a Soyuz launch, you get pictures from inside the capsules, as well as of course, from the outside, from the launch.
And we often see something dangling down. What's that for?
This is a little, how would I say, a little doll or something, which is, it first of all, it's an indicator of zero G. Once you're in zero G, this starts floating. It's not kind of pulled down, and it's kind of a how do you say in English? You know, a little
plumb line, a plumb line to tell where vertical is.
Not really where vertical is, because once you're in zero G, you have no vertical. But it's during the launch, of course, that you see where the vertical is, and then to see the moment when you're in zero G, which is actually pretty obvious.
How much control over the Soyuz spacecraft do the cosmonauts have, and how much is on automatic?
Depends on the phase of the flight, but basically everything is going on fully automatically, but you have up to 100% possibility to interject and perform the various maneuvers manually. And when I talk fully automatically, I mean like rendezvous and docking and this kind of stuff. There is no intervention during the ascent, during the launch itself. This is done fully automatically.
Must be pretty spectacular when the launch escape system jettisons.
Well, in fact, it is very spectacular. I've seen that happen on a movie, and a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine actually, he was in that capsule and he survived that. It's a very spectacular event.
And when they let off the side boosters, you know, they've got the core module on the Soyuz vehicle, and then the four side rockets are jettisoned. Are you aware of that? As a cosmonaut on board the Soyuz?
Yes, you are aware, and you feel that also very much, because when that happens, the G-load in a very short time, within a second, drops from like 4 to 5 G down to almost 0 G. So you really feel that very hard.
And staging must be pretty spectacular too.
staging is when you separate the stages. Yeah, well, that's what I described, is the separation of this first stage. They call this first stage when the four strap-on boosters separate, and then once the second stage is separated, that's the same thing. And once you get separated from the booster, you know, once you're in orbit, that's again a very impressive event. It's like you get a big kick into your back, and then you are in orbit and floating.
At what stage do you get your first view of the Earth?
What's happening is after about, I forgot how many seconds this is, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, the fairing or the shroud separates, and from that moment on you can look outside the window, and you see the horizon and the black space already. But once you're really kind of pressed into your seat, so you're not really getting an opportunity to look outside. But once you are separating from the booster and you are in orbit in zero G, you can look down immediately. But the experienced cosmonauts tell you not to do that, because your vestibular system is disturbed quite a lot, and it might cause some sickness. So they tell you at the beginning not to look outside and to look at the Earth, because they say you get dizzy, which is true actually. You do get dizzy.
Did you look?
Of course I did, because you're curious. I experienced the dizziness, but I was able to handle it. I didn't get sick.
And you then spend a day or two in Earth orbit before you approach the space station. How long did you actually spend on your mission in that state?
That's correct. You spend 2 days before you reach the space station, and my whole mission was 8 days, so I spent 6 days in the Mir.
And how did you see the space station as you approached it? Did you have any view of it, or is it only a periscope view you get?
We had the first view in a distance of maybe it was like 60 kilometers, and then we entered into the the dark side, and when we got back we saw the station pretty clear.
And during those 2 days when you're approaching the station as a research cosmonaut, did you have anything to do?
Yes, not very much, because it's for the whole crew it's not very much to do. You check communication systems, and you're responsible for that, and you're responsible for life support systems, so you make sure everything is fine.
And the docking, was that pretty spectacular, or just a non-event almost?
The docking is actually almost a non-event. It's spectacular in the sense of making sure that everything goes okay, and because there's always the possibility that the automatic docking system doesn't work. So you watch everything very carefully, and you're ready any second to step in and do it manually. In our case, it worked just great. Everything worked fine, and you approach the station closer and closer, and then in about 15 meters distance, you hold the distance and wait that everything is okay, and then you get the command from the ground to proceed, and you just dock. And the docking you hardly feel it. You feel like a little bump, but that's it. It's not very. It's not like a crash with the car against the wall or something. It's pretty soft actually.
And once you're docked in and you've got a hard dock in, how long before you can open the hatch and climb into the Mir?
That takes about, I'd say, an hour and a half to 2 hours, because you need to, first of all, it takes some time till all the mechanical connections are done and till this takes place. And then once that's done, you need to check if everything is sealed, if that's okay, So you watch the pressure, and that takes some time. Therefore, it's almost 2 hours till you really can open the hatch.
Must be a great feeling to finally open that hatch and meet these other guys that have been up there for some months. For example, is there a smell or something when you open the door?
Well, of course, it's a very exciting moment when you open the door. There is no smell in there. I was actually surprised. I was paying very much attention to that. There was a smell when I was then, floating from the spacecraft to the space station. You're going through a tunnel, and you smell this metallic smell, which because the tunnel, you have these metallic structures. But once you're in the station, you have no smell.
And the other folks, how long had they been up there before you met them?
They were up there, like 5 months.
And your job on board the Mir was?
I had a whole lot of scientific experiments to do. They were mostly in the field of life science, then Earth observation and some material science experiments.
And all successful? Any problems with them?
Actually, they were all successful. I was able to perform all of them. There were with a couple of three of them some problems. We were solving that on board and didn't stop us from doing that actually. So we fixed all the problems and actually most of it was done great and I finished the whole program.
Now, had the station been fully constructed by the time you're up there?
No, the station was not in the configuration where it's right now. At my time, it looked like a T. So after my flight, they added another two modules.
And are each of these modules different, or are they pretty much the same design?
They're pretty much the same design. It's the basic same structure. It's just that the internal scientific equipment is different. One is more for life science. The other one is more for experiments to grow crystals. The other one is more for Earth observation. The next one is more for astrological purposes, looking to the stars. So that's the difference between the modules.
I think you mean astronomical.
I mean astronomical, right.
Okay. And which module were you primarily working in?
I was working in the main module and in the module with the cameras which are focused towards pointed towards the Earth.
Was there a progress attached when you were up there? Wouldn't have been, would it? Because you had two Soyuz attached at that time.
That's correct. There was no progress at that time.
And you came down on the other Soyuz, didn't you?
That's right. I came down on the other Soyuz, which was the one where my British colleague Helen Shearman was going up.
And inside the station, extremely cluttered. Well, it is now, as you see it, pictures we see it of it today. At your time, was it also cluttered?
Well, this depends very much on how the crew takes care of stuff. And when I arrived, the crew cleaned up the stuff very much, and it was very clean and spacey. If you watch the pictures, it looks like it's pretty crowded. The problem is that, everything is floating around and it's not like here on ground when you have a cable or a wire on the ground, it lays on the ground, everything starts floating around, so you have to really take care that you fix everything somewhere on the side or at the bottom or at the upper side. Otherwise, it starts just floating around, so it takes immediately, it looks like it's pretty messy, but it's not.
Of course, since the accident they had on there, and they had to close the hatch pretty suddenly and cut off cables and so on, the cables strung through hatchways and so on. Was that a concern to you at the time?
You mean like more than accident, or what should be a concern for me at that time?
The fact that there were through the hatchways that you'd need to close if there was a depressurization, as indeed did happen later on during David Wolfe's mission, Mike Fogg's mission. These cables would take some time to cut, and the air conditioning tubes and so on that spread their way right through the station. Were they a concern to you at the time, or did you sort of not be too much aware of that?
To be honest, I was not looking too much into that. That didn't really worry us, and obviously some other people also not till the moment where this accident happened, and ever since people now changing the designs and making sure that this is not a problem.
So you have had some words with the people doing space station design then?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, this is every crew is doing that. Once they come down, they have a debriefing with all the people responsible for the various subsystems and designs, because there's always something to learn and make better, and that's happening. This is an ongoing process.
What does it sound like on board that space station?
The sound is... how would I say? It's like maybe in an airplane. It's pretty noisy. It's actually very noisy because of a whole bunch of fans running, which are circulating the air, so it's very noisy.
And is there much noise when it goes from daylight into darkness, or vice versa, you know, expansion and so on? Because, you know, like you live in a house and you can hear it creaking and groaning as it, you know, as the temperatures change. Does that happen on the station?
Well, at least you don't hear it, and it's probably good that you don't hear it, because it could be pretty exciting then. No.
The thought that just outside those thin walls is a vacuum, was that a worry? The thought that maybe a meteorite or another piece of space debris might hit this craft?
Well, you know, if you look out of the window or you're in these modules and you're there and look out, and then, you know, you're aware that, well, just through this very thin wall, there's vacuum, and that's the end of the life. You get to think about it, but it's not really worrying you.
The view out the window must, of course, be spectacular. Did you get much time to actually watch the world go by?
Well, there was not much time planned for me, but I took the time. It's just that, you know, you take your time from, like, rests or sleeping, and, of course, this is one thing you certainly want to do, is look out of the window and enjoy the view of the home planet.
Any particular view that springs to mind, it stays in your memory?
Many. It's just everything so beautiful. Australia, if I look, remember Australia, that was very impressive, looking down at the Australian continent. There are so many beautiful things.
What about the Earth at night?
Also very interesting when you follow, you know, the... When you fly over Europe, for instance, and you can follow, okay, here's London, then you have Paris, Vienna, and then you kind of follow your orbit, you see the lights. This is very impressive.
The folks that you flew up with, did they stay on the station, didn't they? There's a crew change on your flight?
The commander changed, actually. The other one, which was the first cosmonaut from Kazakhstan, he returned back with me, so we both stayed only 8 days, but the commander was changing.
You have a special couch made for the Soyuz, and you have to change that over when you come down on a different craft.
A special count, you mean?
Yeah. A couch for launching.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yes, that's right. Since we had to change the spacecraft, we were taking our special design seats or couches, and we changed that to the one where we were then landing. That's right, we had to do that.
And that changeover marks the point where you're committed to coming down on the other craft, aren't you?
Sorry, I didn't understand the question. Say again.
That marks the point at which you're committed to coming down in the alternative craft.
That's exactly right. As long wherever your couch is, that's the spacecraft where you go in any emergency case. So if that's already the new one, then you have to go to the new one. Yeah.
The re-entry, is that basically automatic control, or is it under manual control?
It is basically automatically controlled, and it also worked automatically in our case.
Friends, the re-entry into Earth, of course, involves fairly high G-forces and so on. And if a cosmonaut had to take over and do a manual re-entry, how would they be affected by having been in space for about 4 or 5 months?
Well, that's certainly not an easy job, because being in zero G for some time, of course, has an impact on your body. But I think they would be able to do it. They feel the G load much more than it really is. I remember, when we re-entered, and after a few seconds we had the feeling, oh god, this is already pretty high G force. And then we looked at the instrument and it indicated 0.3 G, and then we looked at each other and said, oh Jesus, it's going to be at least 10 times to 20 times as much. So you can manually control this then. So if you feel it's getting too hard for you, you kind of take it easier. But they have a visual display with a path, a given path, which they have to follow. So it's not that bad. I mean, we practice that a lot in the centrifuge, and we are used to this kind of situation.
And what was the peak load on you, and for how long does the re-entry last?
The peak load was somewhere between 4.5 and 5 G. And that lasts for, I forgot, maybe 6 minutes or something. And then you have, once the parachute opens, another 16 seconds of high G load with high rotation. That lasts, 16 seconds, of course. And then, once the parachute is open, you have only the very impact on the ground.
And do you have any sensation of falling or anything as you come down on the parachute?
Of falling?
Yeah.
Well, actually not really, because you're coming from zero G, and zero G is actually falling. So actually it's the opposite. You feel like you're slowed down, and you feel that already you're hanging. So it's not falling, but more the opposite, like hanging.
And were the recovery team on hand at your landing, or were you a bit off target?
No, absolutely, we were on target. We actually missed the very target point, I think, by 8 kilometers or 7, something like that. And they were right there. They already, were joining us during the descent phase, the last few hundred meters. So there was no problem.
And you, of course, only having been up there for about, 8 days, wasn't it, would have been able to clamber out unassisted. But what about the others? Were they, the one that had been up there for some months, did he need some help to get out?
Well, it's the landing is not a real pleasure. So once they opened the hatch, you kind of, we were tumbling, and so we were not really in the proper position to come out. We were tilted, so we had to kind of crawl out. And everyone can do that. Of course, they help you. They try that you make as least movement as possible. And once you're out, they carry you anyway. I mean, they don't let you even walk around. And you wouldn't probably be able, because the coordination is not working properly, so you would have problems to walk.
After you obviously recovered from your flight and so on, did you have any continuing involvement with the experiments that you'd been doing?
Yes, actually, immediately the very first day, it continues, and for several days, sometimes even weeks, you are involved in activities related to these experiments, in data collection process and debriefings and this kind of stuff. So you very much, the job is not over with the landing, absolutely not.
And after that you went back to Austria, and you resumed back at the Polytechnic, did you?
No, I was 2 years involved in debriefing activities and, you know, lecture tours and so on, employed by the government. And then after these 2 years, I went to the United States, and I'm working now for Boeing in the space business.
And what are you doing for Boeing?
I'm here responsible for international business development in the Boeing Space and Communications Group.
Was it a hard decision to decide to leave Austria?
Well, you know, it's always kind of everything has two sides. I mean, there's new challenges, there's something new to learn, and on the other side, you know, you leave your home country, so it's also not easy. But you're always looking for the good sides in life and the new challenges.
Boeing's very much involved in developing the space station. Would you like to go up to the space station when it's built? That's the International Space Station, of course, not overlooking the series of Russian ones they've had.
Oh, absolutely, and Boeing is heavily involved, of course, in the space station and also, you know, in the space shuttle. So a launch in the space shuttle to the space station and coming back on the shuttle would be a nice thing, and Boeing could do all that.
Well, I certainly hope that you get your chance to go back up there again, and certainly an experience that I'd love to enjoy as well. Well, thank you for joining us on the Space Show, Franz.
Well, thanks a lot, and I hope you know, many more people in the future will get the opportunity to enjoy such a feeling.
Well, thank you.